Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 23rd, 2002. Today's session is Restoring and Maintaining the Holden Landscape, Crossing Over from Facts to Values, presented by Stephen Stephanidis. The session number is STS 2002-05. Let's listen in.
Today, what I want to do is I plan these five sessions as a whole, and my target is to talk about the idea of ecosystem health. This is an idea that figures very prominently right now in discussions of management of ecosystems, and that term may sound sterile when you're talking about, you know, the management of a national park, but it's a term that folks use, and it's in the law. I mean, people talk, there are statutes that are written where they talk about guarding ecosystem health and integrity, and that's another term. Now, to kind of give you a sense of a current controversy, there are people, and now we're talking about scientists, okay, people who do ecology, people who do earth system science at various levels. There's a controversy, and the controversy is about ecosystem health. We're going to stay in here today, so you guys will...
Oh.
There's one camp that feels that the idea, the concept, is an extremely useful one, that it actually is something that can be measured in the way that, like we could measure stream flow, okay? Although I've never heard anyone say that we're at that point yet, but there is one camp that believes that we will be able to work towards that goal. There is another camp that believes that this concept can't be used in that way, and furthermore, that to depend on it is dangerous. Now, see, the interesting thing here is that both of these camps are people who are pro-environment. So it's not like people that are anti-environment and people that are pro-environment. So, because if you go from value to facts to actions, you have to bridge from one up to the other. And if you're in a context where there are other groups that are opposed to your viewpoint, to your proposed actions, what will happen is that the other group will say, where is there a weakness that I can attack? Is the science weak? Is the plan of action weak? Is the bridge from value to fact weak? And this concept is offered up as a bridge from value to fact. And there's great concern that this might be a place that could be attacked fruitfully. In other words, if you say, well, I say that because this ecosystem is in bad shape, we should do X, Y, and Z based on the science, and someone comes along and says, ecosystem health is nonsense, then you have a problem. So there's this controversy going on now to try to head that problem off. And it's a great controversy because it's really sharpening people's sense of how values and facts fit together. And I think one thing that it's going to do is it's going to sharpen people's sense of how important the groundwork of the kinds of values that people bring to this are. So anyway, I have read some papers, and I brought extra copies, and I thought that would be cruel and unusual punishment. So I'm going to try to summarize these. These are three papers, one from 95, which is entitled Ecosystem Services and Management Options as Blanket Indicators of Ecosystem Health. Now there's this idea here. First of all, there is a thing. This fellow, his name is Report, he's the chair of a department at the University of Guelph in Ontario. Okay, so here's a claim. This is what this paper is about. There is a thing called ecosystem health, And it is best understood in terms of something called ecosystem services and management options. Okay. Then here is something from a book that just came out, literally hot off the press, about water quality, and it says health and integrity are meaningful for environmental management. Okay, so that's a fairly unambiguous claim. And then here's one by two Canadian ecologists. Ecosystem health and integrity? Question mark. This is con. Okay, but remember, all three of these groups are people who believe very passionately that we need to protect the environment, that we need to have the appropriate management practices and so forth. And there's this concern that this concept may not be appropriate.
Are they all Canadian?
No.
The middle one?
Actually, this author of this book, both authors are from the University of Washington, and these two are Canadians. So, anyway, now, let me summarize what we've done in the last 4 days, just to sort of bring you up to speed on that. We have looked about, and we have looked at this place's geology, how it functions as a whole bounded ecosystem. We've looked at the fire biology and history of this area. And then we've talked about specific human impacts. And I raised the question yesterday, for instance, for the Holden Mine. Okay, the Holden Mine, there is this big pile of tailings. You have snow melt going through it. It brings out all kinds of bad stuff. And we have a stream that has been impacted in some sense from this tailings pile. The question is, what should you do? Now, this is the current spring 2002 update on site cleanup activities. Okay. Now, as I said yesterday, there are 7 options on the table, and there hasn't been a choice made. And those options range from no action to capping with plastic, to capping with concrete and bounding it, to moving the entire tailings pile into a single unit and capping and bounding it, making a wetland down below, re-logging the creek, and so forth. And an obvious question is, how do you decide amongst these things? I mean, that's an amazing range of options. How do you decide? Now, you might decide, for instance, that, well, we need to do something. We believe that we should have a healthy environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we can do science that can tell us things about water quality, about stream flow, about whether or not that pile of tailings will come into the creek if we have a large quake, which we will have here, because this is an area of infrequent, very large earthquakes. But we need to make a connection. Now, something else. On Wednesday, we went through the forest, and we looked at some trees, and we discovered something interesting. I think we discovered something interesting, and that is that this forest has changed since fire has been suppressed. If you go out and look, you'll see that there are large Douglas firs that are charred down at the bottom, and they are spaced apart quite broadly. There are a few big ponderosa pines, almost no small ponderosa pines, and many, 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 many firs that have come up since the last fire that charred the base of these big trees. And that will have, it's already been a human impact. If there's a fire in here, it will be another human impact, although an indirect one. Now, that's odd, because you say, well, we haven't done anything in here. That's not true. Fire's been suppressed, and so the forest has changed. So there's a question, and this is a big question in the West right now, which is, what should be done? In some cases here, the question is starting to come to the surface. In the Tahoe Basin, The question is at the service and has to be dealt with, because there, because of fire suppression and because of a change in the forest, almost half the forest is standing and dead. And if a fire comes into the Tahoe Basin, as it will burn the forest down, and there are usually about 250,000 people in the basin, and only two ways out. So there's a great concern about this. Now, the flip side of it, or not, to take care of the situation, costs $3,000 an acre to bring the forest back. But the, you know, and so you can say, well, what should be done? How do we make these decisions? My final layer of work, it's generally agreed that the Earth's atmosphere is changing because of human activities. That's going to have, all ecosystems are going to have impacts because of this. Once again, the question is, what should be done and why? And there are a range of options. So anyway, that's the playing field. That's the science. Now we want to do a little bit of philosophy, so this is going to be an interesting turn. Do you have any questions at this point, or any comments? This makes sense. Okay, all right. Now, first of all, I'm going to do this here. The idea of health. Okay, if we have, we say, well, okay, we can understand how various portions of the world work, and then we ask the question, well, what outcome do we want to have? And one idea is that we want to have healthy ecosystems. Okay, so what's health? Okay, this is a class. Now, what we're doing now is a classical philosophical exercise. If you've ever read Plato, for instance, every dialogue is about defining things. He wants to know about piety. He wants to know about virtue. Okay, so we're going to talk about health. And furthermore, we're going to talk about it in terms of this being a useful concept, not only for humans or for animals, but for whole ecosystems. Okay, so for persons, what's health? Go ahead and tell me what you write up there for persons. Or for, let's do this. Let's say for animals. What's health?
It's different for persons and animals.
Well, let's say drinking water.
Shelter.
For the organism itself, if you said for deer, for instance, what's a healthy deer?
Well-nourished.
Okay. If it's well-nourished, it's probably flourishing. Okay? Flourishing. So there's a positive aspect to it. There's also a lack of
disease.
Lack of disease. Okay. So there's two, lack of disease. All right, now, we could inquire into this, and we might find that this one here probably we have a good handle on. This one, the positive one, is harder. And this is something that's intrigued me, because one of the things I know that the Greeks were really, they had a good concept of a positive concept of health. And that's something that isn't really prevalent in my consciousness, and I think it's sort of a cultural thing. We tend to have a hands-off. If you're not sick, you're healthy. But there is a positive aspect of it. And it turns out that this is going to be really important when we talk about ecosystem health. People focus on this a lot. Okay, so we've got this positive aspect and a negative aspect for animals. Okay, now, let's go ahead and we'll try to make the bridge. Ecosystems. Now, there's something you need to remember. The idea of an ecosystem is probably no more than 50 or 60 years old. Okay? An ecosystem is an abstraction. It's a model. Just like I can say, you know, biological community, I can talk about the ponderosa pine community. That's an abstraction too, because we won't find a ponderosa pine community out here. There's, you know what I mean? You don't, if it's a tree farm, you might find one. But in nature, what happens is people want to do some work and they say, well, it's convenient. They play with the idea, and if it's useful, they run with it. There's a saying that all models are bad models, but a good model is less bad than others. Okay. So anyway, the first person to really make this bridge was a guy named Aldo Leopold, and I will only write him up here to erase him. He's an interesting man. He was from the Midwest, and he began as a trapper, and he worked for the Forest Service, and he ended up writing a beautiful book called The Sand County Almanac, in which he has a great essay called A Land Ethic, and it's a great book. But he had this idea from the 30s, from what he saw in the 30s, of land sickness, where you had topsoil blowing away, where you had, species lost, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if we have a lack of disease, well, we need to know what it is to have a disease in an ecosystem. That's the problem. You think about that. What does it mean? I mean, if you're talking about an ecosystem, if you're talking about the physical plus the biotic, what's alive plus the physical component, what would it mean, first of all, to have disease, and secondly, to have a lack of disease? That's a tough question. Now, again, remember, why is this an urgent question? Because these are things that are being dealt with in courts of law. You know what I mean? It's not like we can just stop for 200 years, work this stuff all out, and then say, okay, now, you know, people are wanting to do things. I have a map here. I'm going to open up. And this is a map of our forest. And I want to try to find this opening so that I can point out something to you. This is Lake Chelan. Okay. Here's Railroad Creek, and here's the tailings piles, and here's Holden, and look at that. That's the claim. Mm-hmm. Now I want to show you something else on the other side. See that? That's an unmined claim that has a lot more ore in it. Now this is in the Glacier Peak Wilderness, which was established by an act of Congress. Now Holden flourished during a time of war. From 1938 until 57, I mean, of that time, almost all of it, certainly from 41 to 52, we were at war. Copper is used in shell casings. Okay, so there was great impetus for this mine to be open. So I could certainly imagine situations, even barring war, where this ore body might be mined. It would be nice to have a way of proceeding that we felt good about from our ethical. So this discussion was aimed at that sort of thing. It was really interesting to see that. It's like just on the other side of Cloudy Pass. Okay, so this is, what did I do with my pen? Oh, here we go. Got to keep the caps on. I have chalk usually, which I like much more because when the caps get left off, they dry out. Okay. So anyway, land sickness. So there's a problem here. Can you really see? Because when you have an organism, you have an integrated system such that I can't, for instance, take out your kidneys. It's not compatible with life. Now, here's an interesting point. I can cut down all the trees in a valley. And what may happen is I may get a completely different ecosystem. I can change the climate. And it's not that I won't have an ecosystem there, I'll have a different ecosystem. So, you know, that's why I think that when people use strong rhetoric of we are ruining the earth, you have to be careful, because if you overstate that case, you can get in trouble. Let me describe something to you. If you go to Mount St. Helens, you observe the effects of a very small volcanic eruption. I mean, as far as the Cascadian volcanoes go, that's a small one. Now, the Toutle River watershed has been totally altered, but there's an ecosystem there. And here's another point that I want to raise. I think that any concept of ecosystem health, or any bridging concept from values to facts, needs to apply in cases like that. Okay, do you understand what I'm saying? Because this brings in something that I've tried to impress on you for the last 4 days, and that is that even on a short scale, Earth is dynamic. It's not static. There was a time in the 60s and 70s, late 70s, very late 70s, I was an undergraduate, when people had this idea that if you had a piece of land and you did something, or if you just let it alone, it would come to what's called a climax community, and then it would stay there kind of forever, like some ideal form. And what's happened since then is people have studied this issue more, and they realize that isn't what happens. There's no such thing. So the Earth behaves differently than that. So there's this, I'm going to write this down here. Okay, so any fact-value bridge, let me put values first because that's important. Value-fact bridge. It's got to apply for natural, and this includes what we'll call nice ecosystem, stuff that we consider nice like this, as well as ravaged. Yellowstone National Park, what happened in 1988?
Big fire.
That big fire. Guess what? Those big fires happen about every 100 years in Yellowstone. Before Anglos came, about 30,000 acres burned, no, wait a minute, 30 million acres burned each year in the West. When mapping was being done in the 1860s, there was this, by people like Powell and Whitney, there was this constant complaint that for about 2 or 3 months, they couldn't get any work done because they couldn't see because of all the fires. That's just the way it was. Because we have 14,000 lightning-caused fires in the West every year that are reported. So this is the way things have been. So you have to ask, okay, if we have a concept that works, we have to be able to say, go across the lake. And as hard as that is, look at this place and say, wow, this ecosystem is in a state where it's okay, even though it looks to our eyes like sin. You know what I mean? Blackened trees and so forth and so on. Furthermore, I think that this has to, well, let's see here. I'm going to use a different term. It has to work in domesticated landscapes. And here, I like things that are said by Wendell Berry. You know what I mean? We have to say, okay, if we understand how to bridge this value fact chasm, then if we're talking about farms, for instance, wheat fields, orchards, we have to be able to say, well, there are some that are healthy, some that are not. So what we're searching for is a concept that holds all of this. Okay, anyway, but there's a problem here. Lack of disease, I don't even know what this means here. And I don't even know, so we've got a problem here. We've got a problem with the whole term. I'm just not sure what it means. Okay? Because I come to it with my own perceptions, my own time frame. We tend to think in terms of 5 generations, right? 2 in the past, ours, 2 in the future. Norm, in here, I almost feel like I shouldn't be treading the same area. What was his time frame? From the beginning to the end. Okay. Under the, as a thing that lasts eternally. I don't speak Latin, I know there's a term. What is it? Subspecies? Yeah, you know. So that, again, is an interesting issue. All right, let me get rid of Leopold. See, normally if this is chalk, this is where my hands are always cracked. Yeah. Okay, now, flourishing. Okay, flourishing. When is an ecosystem healthy? Well, what I just dragged you through, you can see there's a problem with this, too. You go across the lake and you go, Yellowstone. Well, look at it from the standpoint of bigger time or bigger area. For instance, lodgepole pine forests. If you look at them, you'll see that there are it's like a, it's sort of like a quilt. And what happens when a fire goes through is a stand will burn, one stand will live, another stand will burn, and this goes on over hundreds of years. And what happens is that in lodgepole pine forests, because of their biology, it's natural for them to burn to the ground in areas, and in other areas not burn to the ground. So if you consider the whole Yellowstone ecosystem, then you start to see a different kind of pattern. Whereas if I drop you down in it and you hit in a giant cloud of ash, you go, this is awful. You know, this is bad. This is an unhealthy ecosystem. But from another perspective, you say, well, maybe it's not unhealthy. Okay, so we have a problem here with flourishing. What does it mean for an ecosystem to be flourishing? Then we have a problem with this idea of the analogy. Okay, a body, again, there are certain things I can't do to you. I can't cut your brain out. That's not compatible with life. If I cut down all the trees in here and I change the climate, give it 1,000 years, we may have something very beautiful here. Aesthetically, you know, we say, oh, wow, this is 17,000 years ago, so science tells us, we would have been looking up at the snout of a retreating glacier here. Okay, so how healthy is that ecosystem? Okay, we don't even have lichen on the ground, for heaven's sakes, let alone trees. And likely this will come back. Because we're in an ice age. So that's something. So this is an interesting problem. Now, one of my authors, let me see if I can pick this out. I don't usually talk about things this way, but maybe I can. Here we go. Words like health and integrity are embedded in these laws, the Clean Water Act, Canada's National Park Act, the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, because they are inspiring to citizens and a reminder to those who enforce the law to keep their minds in the big picture. Now that's an interesting thing. So now here what we're saying is what's the value of ecosystem health? It's rhetorical. In other words, I'm going to use it to convince people. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and write this down here. Rhetorical value. And I don't mean to demean it. Okay, like I think one of the things about what Norm had to say yesterday, I think that the way that Job is set up, using poetry to express that very technical language, where he's using science language, measure, place, all of this stuff, using poetry has great power. So there's nothing wrong with rhetoric. Okay, but there's this idea, we might have a different use for this. So what do you think about ecosystem health? You like this? Would you like someone to trundle into a suit of law where you were, you know, you said that on behalf of the whatever, the, you know, on the behalf of Railroad Valley, you know, we're going to file suit against whoever not to, and then you ultimately everything comes down to ecosystem health. How do you feel about that?
Well, because it's so hard to define what ecosystem health is, then it scares me that anyone could use statistics to prove whatever point they want.
Possibly so, or someone might be able to do what I did in a court of law and maybe make the judge feel like this is nonsense. This is a weak analogy that only has, and if you play this card as bridging value to fact, you lose whatever rhetorical value it might have had if you were up front by saying, well, we've got this other concept, but you can think of it as health. You know what I mean? Then you can sort of, well, yeah, okay, they've got this nice solid idea here that goes from value to fact. And I can kind of feel that. So that's an interesting point, because I'm always thinking of strategies. You know, you have to. Because right now, the hold in mind, okay, let me just read you the timetable. In fall of 2002, according to this project schedule, listen to this. Fall 2002, begin consent decree negotiations for the action. Negotiations. Okay, that means attorneys. Okay, people who spend their lives framing arguments and who love to be combative. Okay, that's what attorneys do. All right. So, anyway, another term: integrity. Okay, so here we're going to sort of go. Let's try another one. Integrity. What does this mean? Ecosystem integrity. Well, we come to an understanding of how things function, and we have an idea that, well, if you start to take parts out, you lose the ability to do something. Well, what's that? Now I'm very sad to tell you what's that is. The ability to, one, deliver ecosystem services, and two, management options. Now, what are we defining things in terms of here?
People.
Not just people. Ecosystem services. We're probably thinking about things that we can quantify, dollars and cents. And you should be aware that there is, and this comes from Paul Ehrlich, mainly down at Stanford, out of his lab, there's this idea of ecosystem services. Okay, and this is what ecosystem services are. In the most inclusive sense, they're defined as all functions performed by ecosystems, such as recycling of nutrients, sequestering of toxics, provision of renewable resources, shelter, and cultural identity. So there's a drive to put a value on things like, what is the atmosphere worth? One way to look at that is, if you were to do certain things that remove the atmospheres, what it does biologically, in the Earth system sense, what would it cost to replace it? In Tahoe, what's the value of the forest? What's the value that's been put on it? $3,000 an acre just to make it fire safe. There are a lot of acres in the Tahoe Basin. You know, and this has been a really useful thing, because it's made people think, wow, you know, the Earth really, it does things in this economic sense. And you know what's interesting is that economics, I can't help but point this out, they all have the same root, the house. Okay, so economics is the laws of the house. This is the study of the house, the house system. Okay, so there's this idea that we have ecosystem services. So you could look at this watershed and you could say, well, there are various ecosystem services. And to understand that, you really have to take a whole variety of views. There's local ecosystem services. This valley participates in global ecosystem service budgets. And obviously people are having a field day with this. Okay, but, and here's where okay, you need to realize something. Ecosystem services, you're defining in terms of people and people's preferences. Now there's a problem here because you're quite a ways over and all of a sudden you're way across on the value side of the value stack. And again, someone says, well, this isn't science. Your preferences are embedded in your science. That would scare me if I had someone tell me that. And I was, you know what I mean? Because all of a sudden, it looks very subjective. Now, science is subjective in a sense, but science is constrained subjectivity. And the constraint is nature. So whether you're a naive realist or whatever, there is a constraining. You know what I mean? I mean, when you, if someone works for some company, tobacco company, and they have results that blah, 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 well, we know that those results were cooked because someone else went out and did the experiments and didn't cook the data and revealed that because nature constrains, the world constrains, the wisdom, to use norms, constrains, okay, the way things work. But there is a subjective element. But if you have too much of a subjective element, you lay yourself open to the charge that, well, you've cooked the data. So there's a problem there. Now, this management option thing. Okay, this was observed. When people came into this country, one of the things that delighted them, to use this terminology, was a tremendous range of management options. You know? This was a new world. There were all, you know, people just, their mind, you know, they could do whatever they wanted. Okay, now what we've observed is that that's no longer the case. When you can't drink the water, you've lost a lot of management options. Okay? So, now, this to me is probably stronger than this. But there's a problem, and it has to do with our adaptability. Let me give you an example. When a forest is logged, and, well, when it's mined, okay, timber mining versus good logging, what happens is something comes back, either because it's planted or whatever. Now, the forest that comes back may not be as valuable even in a dollars and cents sense. But we will find a way, right? It's called high grading. You figure out a way to cut that stuff down and make it into fiber work or paper. In the South, loblolly pines, thousands of acres of monocultures of these little pines, and they have these machines that cut them down like a lawnmower. You know, they grow them up until they're a certain size and they cut them down and they make paper out of them. Now, the forest that was there originally was good for making beautiful furniture, for making ships, massive, you know what I mean? If you think about the economy of 18th and 19th century times, you know, if you can make massive ships and lay keels down and so forth and so on, you know, that's worth a lot. It's the same thing that getting copper out of this hill lets you do. Now, what can you make? Paper. And I'm not putting paper down. I love paper. Paper's great stuff. But nonetheless, you can't make the, you know, you can't, you've lost, but we have adapted. Humans have perhaps an evil genius for concentration camp. People will, you know, they can even learn to live in that setting. So, there's a problem here in that, to put it bluntly, we can learn to live in debased conditions. So, that's a fact, or maybe it's a point of faith.
Are we living or just surviving?
Yeah.
Well, we could pursue that argument, but one way or the other, whether you call it living or just surviving, it is. So this, in practice, is a concern. Okay, now let me take a breather. What do you guys think?
Well, when you cut down all the trees in the Midwest, you had massive floods. They don't replace them, you know, there. And then we didn't learn. We came out here, and they still want to clear cut everything, cut it down. And they should learn from what happened. How many times have the Mississippi and Ohio rivers flooded?
Well, an awful lot of the upper Midwest has gone into the Mississippi Delta.
Right.
And it's still going into the Mississippi Delta.
Is that an option, that we have to live with what we've destroyed there? I mean, is that a good option, let's put it that?
We are. There's an example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, see, this is interesting because it strikes me when I look at the responses of the indigenous people that were here, the intensity of their dislike of what happened, because it was such a tremendous break with their experience. You know what I mean? Such a tremendous break that, and if you look at the problems that indigenous people have, I mean, to me, I kind of look and say, ultimately, it comes from this unaccommodated despair at the loss. You know, there's just this utter psychic disconnect from a life that was lived in a certain environment. Europe, England is beautiful. I've never been there, but I look at the pictures. That landscape is utterly, totally domesticated.
Yep.
Utterly domesticated.
Yep.
Likewise, the forestry that holds fire suppression to be one of the cardinal is from North Central Europe, where it's extremely humid, and again, you have an utterly domesticated, I mean, the bears in the Alps, people, they're there, but people rarely see them, because the mamas have taught their cubs probably for about, 2,000 years now, that boy, when you see one of those guys on a horse or whatever, you know, you turn tail. There are bears in the Alps. But they're incredibly secretive, unlike our bears. But given enough time, our bears are smart. Grizzlies aren't. They're just too cantankerous. So it's an interesting, again, take a bigger perspective. Take a bigger perspective. And then you start to see. So your points are very well taken. And I think that this is an important point. On the one hand, this may be formally more valuable, but I think it's a really slippery slope, and I think it's a steep one.
How about the dams on the Columbia?
Ooh, could we get into it there? I don't know. See, what can I say? I'm just going to leave it at that. I'm going to say, how about the dams on the Columbia? I recommend a book highly by a guy named called Compass and Gyroscope. And I'm going to come back to this, so I'm going to flip it up here. This fellow was at the University of Washington. He's now at Williams. And he was deeply, deeply involved in crafting the salmon recovery, getting that off the ground. And he wrote this book. Very interesting book. I've got the title right. I'm not totally sure about this. I was going to bring it, and I didn't. Okay, so let me go on. Now, let us suppose that we wipe these away, okay, and we come up with some concept of, I don't know,
throw away the ones that don't work. It drives people crazy.
Okay.
It drives me crazy.
Let's suppose we come up with some appropriate value fat bridge that is relative relative to ecosystems. Let me tell you what my nightmare is. My nightmare is rather like the nightmare of the atomic physicists. Okay, you discover the structure of the atom, and you go, wow, I can really make a big bomb. It's linked to this. You discover the way that the various ecosystems work, and you discover, as it's starting to become clear, that a lot of this stuff, maybe 99% of it, can be swept away and everything will still function. The air will be air, and because this has happened. This has happened at least six times. And it looks like we're in for a seventh, that we're responsible for. And what happens is that you say, well, we don't need this stuff. My question is, what about the individuals? What about the individuals? I think that we need to include that any this needs also to apply to all created beings. Because otherwise you can see what I'm talking about. Things that are superfluous and some, you know, well, we can just get rid of it. A plea for the individual. Okay, now, I'm gonna, so this, we don't have this yet though. We don't have it yet. So what else is there? Well, there is a book that I have right here that I bought in 1978. It's called Should Trees Have Standing Toward Legal Rights for Natural Objects? Has anyone ever read this book? Okay, this guy, at the time he wrote it, was on the law school faculty at USC. And his argument was like this, that he said, we observed that there was a time when those who had legal standing were a very small group. And outside of that group were people of different ethnic heritage, different gender than those inside that group. We know who those were. Etc., etc., etc. And what's happened over time is that we learned how to extend standing to those groups. Now, you say, well, this is, but wait a minute. Trees have standing? Well, corporations have standing. Railroads have standing. They're legal persons. Okay? They're legal persons. What Stone, you know, we could spend a whole day talking about this, but what he argues is very simple, but there's an interesting twist at the bottom. His claim is that what we need to have is this situation. Think about this. Supposing you have a society where you have, we'll have one and two. In one, there's a slave. In both, there's a slave that gets injured. Now, in the first society, the owner of the slave sues for the damages, the lost labor of the slave, and he gets paid. And maybe he pays the slave, you know, maybe he doesn't. Contrast that to a situation where the slave can sue for his lost labor and his injury, and he gets paid. Now there's a third situation. supposing that another group or I, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make this intermediate. So what we have here is we have a slave, and then the owner steps in, and he sues, and the owner gets paid. So the slave just sort of disappears. I mean, this is a bonanza for the owner, right? I mean, maybe he can work it out, and his attorney can actually make a profit on this. Then we have another situation where the slave gets injured, the slave sues, and the slave gets paid. The intermediate case might be something where you have guardians. Is that right? Guardian? Did I misspell that? Guardians who, on the behalf of the slave, sue, and the slave gets paid. Okay? So we have this natural, and this is the progression. Okay, this happened, right, for people that came to this country against their will from Africa, barely or essentially against their will from China to build the railroads, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, here's the interesting point. What drives this? What drives this is Frank. Ethical choice. Right? Before people argued in the courts, there were people who were sensitized to slavery. And so, this is the importance of work like norms. Because the bottom line. So I'll call this, ethical foundations. Okay, now, you may feel a disconnect. I feel a disconnect. What I think is that what has to happen is that there probably is no good fact value bridge. I think that that might be a little bit of an evasion of responsibility. That what needs to happen is the science needs to be clean, it needs to be strong, it needs to be direct, and then, likewise, the ethics have to be the same way. People have to make clear, very clear, that. And what Stone argues for is this to happen now. And what I like about this framework is that there's a place for the individual, you know what I mean? The species that isn't. In other words, if there are people who are sensitized, you don't gain your value just because you are of use in the functioning of an ecosystem, just like you don't gain your value because you're of use in the functioning of a society. And when you no longer have any use in that defined system, but rather, if there are, you know, and maybe the time comes, who knows? I don't expect this to happen with trees and ecosystems and rocks, but when they go, when the slaves are free. But Norm said that Earth has a voice. So maybe one function that we have is to be as transparently as possible, the ears and the audible sound. Anyway, question.
To clarify, are we arguing the spotted owl approach here? Somebody sues on behalf of the spotted owl, preserve its habitat?
Therefore, don't cut down trees.
See, because this is just so interesting. I could teach a whole class on this. If you look, like when, in the 60s and 70s, when the idea of a climax community was framed, that thing had a tremendous ethical flavor to it. In other words, it was like, you know, well, we get this climax community, and therefore, by golly, you had better not disturb it. This is totally different from the way science has been done. Likewise, when you say, the spotted owl has all, it does this and such and the other thing, and therefore, well, hate to say it, but you probably could just make the spotted owl go extinct. and, you know, your timber yields and the water would still be pure and all that. And see, to me, there's a problem with that. Because then, you know, you're saying, well, something gains its value from how it functions within. So if someone is sensitized and can make the case and can evangelize on behalf of, you know what I mean, can raise our consciousness, just like there was a time when people said, well, you know, women. I mean, there's this great thing in here where he quotes at length the first woman who wanted to be able to practice law in the state of Wisconsin, and the decision is just, if I had more time, I'd read it, and it'd really raise your eyebrows, because they go off in this flowery language about the woman's place is this, and she doesn't have the this, and that was the perception in 1889. However, the Northern Pacific Railroad was a person. You know, so, because there was a sensitization to the needs of the Northern Pacific Railroad. So, So then there's this. But I think that what needs to happen is that you don't want to smuggle things into the science, because you open yourselves up. And all of this stuff that we've talked about, really, the problem with it is that when you deal with people that don't agree with your fundamental standpoint, you're in trouble. You know, and it's interesting because these people are great conservation biologists, but they don't like ecosystem health. And that's why they attack it. And I think it's a good attack. I think it's a when I started putting this class together, I was going to tell you, oh, ecosystem health. And then I had a friend over at Western Washington said, I've got some papers you ought to read. And, you know, and so that's
are all the players in the negotiations for the Holden Mine all pro-ecosystem health?
I don't know. That'd be a really interesting. It would be interesting to get at that, to sit down and say, okay,
find out what their backgrounds are,
and what they're bringing to the table.
Yeah, who are they? Who's paying them?
Sure, absolutely. It would be interesting to see the kind. I mean, you could maybe not rightly, but you could say, well, Intalco probably, you know, they have or different views of ecosystem health. See, that's where we really, I've gotten rid of it, but that's where we really get in front. You have a big problem. You know? I mean, first of all, you've got this metaphor, it's leaking at all seams.
Okay.
The keel looks like it's broken, and the thing's demasted. Okay, and then what you're going to do is you're going
to
talk about different varieties of these things. So, there's a name given to this. It's called ecological ethical existentialism. Yeah, you know, it's like you say, well, okay, I'm going to make a choice. But what I like about norm stuff is that there's this grappling with the foundation that is it's quite profound. I mean, I just walked out of here like and I think that needs to be overt. And I think that within, you know, the Christian faith community, there's a tremendous need for people to stand up and to show that they can do the rigorous science, but they can also do this kind of rigorous analysis like he's done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's tough to argue with that picture for me. So, you know, then people start to realize, wow, you know, what is it that I'm fighting against? Do I want to be that kind of a person?
Especially when we're told to be stewards of the earth.
Well, see, it's interesting because Norm would say that the stewardship issue, you know, he says three great narratives. God.
I was here.
You were here. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is going to have to be revisited in light of his analysis. What does it mean? What it means is that right there. So stewardship there is what you're talking about is you're talking about this forever generating, you know, creation, this child that's always bringing forth, and you're going to be in the world of humans the steward. See what I'm saying? I mean, stewardship doesn't, you know, if you have a child and you're their guardian, that's a very tender relationship. You know what I mean? Stewardship, you know, you think of a guy going out with his hoe, well, you know, I don't. it's pretty.
Don't you think stewardship is a guardianship?
I don't know. I think that would be a question that you'd have to ask empirically. You'd have to look for the evidence, and you'd have to see how well does what people say match what they actually do. But I think that the guardianship of a child, anybody who you know, said, well, I'm a good steward, you know, I apply so many thousands of pounds of pesticides to my orchard and so forth and so on, that kind of behavior with a child, you could end up in prison, you know. And again, here's something that I think is always important. We need to be inspired too. And the deep rhetorical value of this idea, I think, is very important, you know. So stewardship and the guardian sense, always ready to advocate.
Don't you think it's kind of scary with these negotiations that are coming up, because you've got EPA, you've got the heirs to Holden, whatever that is.
In Talco.
Are we involved at all in that?
I don't know.
The Holden Village, but you've got
the Forest Service is involved too.
And of course, Talco's going to have lawyers.
So is the Forest Service. Everybody's got lawyers.
And then it's just going to be who's the best lawyer.
Well,
it's scary, really.
But that's the way it was in the 1850s, right? There, tragically, what happened? We fought a war. At that time, the most brutal war that had ever been fought. Shocked Europe. That's my understanding. They couldn't believe it. I mean, what Sherman did was unprecedented. I'm not from the South. You know, I'm just saying, that was a new thing. So that's a good point. Yeah, I'd like to close. Do you know this by Wendell Berry, Sabbaths? It's much bigger now. Wendell Berry, do you know who Wendell Berry, who doesn't know who Wendell Berry is?
The name, but I don't care.
Wendell Berry is a poet, and he lives in Kentucky. He's a graduate of the Stanford Creative Writing Program, and he is a great conscience. He is a Christian. And he's written these poems in his, he has a study somewhere, obviously I don't know what his farm is like, but the farm has been in his family for 7 generations that he farms. And he has a little study that he's built, and he goes and struggles with his poetry, and there's this, he's written a ton of stuff. He's also a great essayist. And Sabbaths is a very beautiful collection of Sabbath poems. And he's got this one, and the poems are very long, so I'm not going to read you a whole, but this is a poem to his son. And a thing that really concerns him, the state of Kentucky, which used to be a paradise kind of place, as you know, is the site of a tremendous amount of major strip mining. And when the strip mining is done, they don't reshape the Appalachians. Mm-hmm. They just leave it as is. But so he's very concerned with this business of bringing nature back, bringing the woods back. There's this one thing where he says, there are two healings, nature's and ours and nature's. Nature's will come in spite of us, after us over the graves of its wasters as it comes to the forsaken fields. The healing that is ours and nature's will come if we are willing, if we are patient, if we know the way, if we will do the work. So, anyway. Any questions, comments?
You depressed me.
Oh, I hope not. I think this is an exciting time to be alive. Because we're so much more aware of what in the world is going on than we were even 20 years ago.
With politics, you can't stop it, though.
But I don't know. Sometimes I get sad, and other times I think to myself, you know what? The system in many cases works really well. So, what else do we have?
Well, I worked in Florida in environmental regulation. And I knew when I left there that it was going to just drop off into the ocean, and I think it's very close to coming there. It's tough. terrible how they have no concern for the environment there.
But there are people who do.
I know, but do you think they have any political connections?
Not really into the bushes.
That's right. Oh, well, this happened before the bushes went there, too. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.